Talking Men with Matt Webb on Cambridge 105.
So it is the final episode in the current series of Talking Men. We'll be hearing from the founder of the Stop Male Suicide Campaign and UK International Men's Day coordinator, Glenn Poole, a little bit later on. But in the meantime, for our final spot on men's mental health, I'm pleased to be joined in the studio, as always, by Councillor Nigel Beaumont. Good afternoon to you.
Afternoon, Matt.
So today we're going to be focusing on some of the topics that we've been discussing over the last 6 weeks.
Yes, that's right. I thought it'd be good to just summarise a bit of what we're speaking about. And it was interesting, Matt and I were talking before we came on air about men and men's problems and their willingness to actually expose themselves to the treatments that are available. And one thing that occurred to me, and it actually comes out of my own practice, is, are there too few men counsellors out there? I'd be really interested to know actually what people think. In my own practice, about 90% of the people I see are men. And the approaches I get are from men as well. And I'm just wondering if they pick up on the various websites and deliberately, you know, come to me because of that.
It's interesting you should say that, because quite often there is this this furore in the news that men don't talk about their problems. Mm, but you say that you get more men coming to you than you do women.
Well, bear in mind, obviously, it's a very small proportion and people have already made the decision that they want counselling. But they're then obviously looking at the various sources of information, the websites and so on. And the ones, I haven't asked them specifically, but the ones that I see, as I say, about presently 90% of my clients are men. So it would be really interesting to get that sort of feedback. And I suppose everyone's different. You know, as you say, your experience was that you found a good female counsellor and it really worked for you. But so I suppose the theme of what I wanted to just talk about is that although I've tried to strip away some of the mystique of counselling and there's so many terms that are attached to it and make it all a little bit mysterious, but it really is an experience that is very positive and very helpful, and anyone that has actually been part of it or taken therapy will actually bear that out. As counsellors, we're taught to be sensitive to the needs of our clients, and a good counsellor will always keep checking in with their client to make sure that they're comfortable, that we're staying within the agreed boundaries. And I think this is important to bear in mind because, you know, a lot of people have voiced the concerns of, oh, well, they're going to unearth things that I'm not very comfortable with. Well, when you are comfortable with them, yes, or by all means talk about them, but it's very much in the control of the client, you know, and as counsellors, we are sensitive to that and we won't take it any further than we feel that you're comfortable. And I think that's a very, very important message to get across. And what often happens is, you know, once you become more familiar with the process, you feel that you want to tell more or talk about more and so on. So just a quick summary of what we spoke about. There's really, the decision needs to be made as to what you're looking for. And of course, if you go via the NHS, you are going to, in most cases, be referred for CBT. That's because they can measure the outcomes and the NHS rather likes that. So in the first case, you'll nearly always be referred for CBT unless you have something specific, like, for example, PTSD, where there are specific treatments which are like EMDR, which we spoke about last month, which is much more helpful and can work in tandem with CBT. If you are not going by the health service and if you, you know, don't want to wait around for the long waiting list that exists, in the private sector, you can go one of two ways. You can go the CBT route, which is really dealing with the here and now. And that's fine for some people. They just really want to get on with life and deal with it. And that CBT is ideal for that. Or you can go for the more in-depth approach, which is the psychodynamic therapy, which I use and have been trained in. And it tends to look towards the origin of the issue and bring that into the consciousness and enable you to be able to work with that. So I suppose the overriding message, and again, Matt and I were just talking about this, is that mental health problems affect anyone, regardless of age, ethnicity, gender, or social background. And the statistics show that men are less likely to seek help than are women. And they also show that anxiety, depression, and compulsive disorders are experienced by 12.5% of all men. That's quite a significant number. And we were talking about suicide rates. I don't have the most recent ones, but in 2014, 78% of the suicides reported involved men. Really, really chilling. So, just in summary, talk to a professional. It's a way of taking back control of your own life. And working with a counsellor helps you establish a much healthier approach to your life and also enables you to devise coping mechanisms. So it's all positive stuff, and I really encourage you to make the call.
Do you think that it's important that the UK government does more to support men, especially those who are suffering from mental health problems and those that are in the at-risk group of committing suicide?
Well, I think, yes, absolutely. There's a recognition that there's an issue that needs to be addressed, and they need to balance it in many ways and make sure that men are aware that these are being addressed. You know, it shouldn't be pushed to one side. It is a major, important issue, and the UK government should certainly pay attention to it.
Do you think they should consult people like yourselves who actually work in the profession?
Yeah, absolutely. We have our own professional body, the BACP, you know, and they are very prominent in these sort of things, and they would provide whatever information and support, but the government most certainly should take notice.
And finally, just to round things off, it's been fantastic having you in for the last 6 weeks, and there are some things which we probably haven't been able to touch upon over the course of the series. Do you want to just elaborate on some of those?
Well, I think there's so many different avenues to follow, and it's impossible over 6 weeks or even 6 months, you know, to really touch on all of them. But it's to recognise that for everything that people experience, there are specific routes that you can actually take, and you can perhaps choose or tailor the approach best suited to yourself. And that's not only in terms of the style of therapy, but it's the way that you actually receive the therapy. We spoke about this last time, in the sense that the internet and the phone and texting and all of these are now available as routes to get therapy. So I think that those sort of things could be explored in a lot more depth, and I think people are not wholly aware that they do exist. What people imagine is that you've got to go to a counsellor and sit with them, and of course that is probably the most advantageous, particularly for long-term therapy, but there are so many other avenues that are now coming to the fore with the internet generation, if you like, and they can be used.
And it's definitely not something to be embarrassed about either.
Absolutely not. There are so many people that use it and see it as a benefit. It's no different from going for a massage, perhaps, if you're a sportsman or something along those lines. It is there to help and support you and to improve the quality of your life.
Well, Nigel, thank you very much for coming in over the last 6 months to talk about the various different therapies available for men recovering from mental health problems. And thank you very much for your contributions. It's made the show very, very important and vital, I think, to the airwaves of Cambridge 105. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Matt. It's been a real pleasure.
Talking Men with Matt Webb on Cambridge 105.
Welcome back. We'll be hearing from Glenn Poole from the Stop Male Suicide Campaign and International Men's Day Coordinator in a couple of moments. But first,
Men's Bits, a roundup of this month's men's issues making the news.
A new tool developed by Addenbrookes Hospital hopes to empower men to take control of their prostate cancer monitoring. It's called Track My PSA. Addenbrookes Charitable Trust funded the software's trial with over £13,000 from its innovation fund. More than 8 in 10 men diagnosed with prostate cancer in England and Wales survive the disease for 10 years or more, and these rates are improving. A Teesside University academic is using her research to shine the spotlight on the sensitive subject of male victims of domestic violence. Dr. Jessica McCarrick, a senior lecturer in counselling psychology, thinks more should be done to support male victims. She says many men don't report the violence they suffer for fear of being the subject of false accusations. And finally, Eddie Redmayne has branded fatherhood amazing and wonderful as he opens up about his baby daughter Iris. The actor became a first-time dad 7 weeks ago when his wife Hannah gave birth to their little girl. The couple, who married in 2014, are currently in Rio enjoying their first big holiday with their baby girl. And that's a full roundup of all this month's men's issues and news in Men's Bits.
Talking Men on Cambridge 105.
Now, it's sometimes said that men's issues don't get spoken about enough on radio or television. One of those who thinks men's issues should be given a larger platform is Glenn Poole. He's the UK coordinator of International Men's Day, which takes place on the 19th of November. He's also gone on to found the Stop Male Suicide campaign in Australia. Glenn starts by telling me what got him interested in men's issues.
For me, very much it was fatherhood. So I was an at-home dad 20 years ago. And that was quite interesting in itself, seeing the barriers that there are to dads being involved in their kids' lives. So I got involved in writing about that experience and talking to other dads who were at-home dads and struggling in different ways, and coming up against some quite sexist attitudes towards men with kids. So that was quite an eye-opener. And I lived in the London borough of Hackney at the time, which had this reputation for being the most politically correct borough in the entire world. And yet you could still walk into a doctor's surgery or a council swimming pool and see all these signs for directed at mothers with babies, and with no acknowledgement of the fact that there were fathers with babies there. So that was quite interesting. And then I had the misfortune to go through separation when my daughter was sort of between 2 and 3 years old, and discovered just how appalling the whole system around family breakdown and what we do to ensure that mums and dads stay involved in their kids' lives when they can no longer get on with each other or live together. And I was fortunate to be given joint custody, kind of despite of, not because of the system. I then got very involved. I thought, well, if I found it so difficult, and I was a full-time at-home dad, how difficult must it be for your traditional father, who's sure involved, hands-on, involved in childcare in some way, but is actually the primary breadwinner and spends most of the time out of the home. And that's when I really started to discover some of the real difficult circumstances that separated fathers were facing in the UK and around the world, and got massively involved in campaigning for family law reform and for better rights for separated dads, good dads who wanted to be fully involved in their kids' lives but were being stopped various reasons because our system isn't set up to support separated fathers very well. So that's where it started for me. It's like many people who are passionate campaigners and advocates, there's a personal journey there. It's about my personal story, but I've carried on regardless of that, because I'm a fully involved father. I've got a great relationship with my daughter, which is constantly evolving, so there's not like a sense of personal bitterness there. But that personal lived experience, I think, is massively important if you're sort of trying to advocate for a group in society, particularly a group, men and boys, who aren't very often recognised as a group that's in need of help and support.
Yeah, well, quite often we see on television campaigns for girls and women. Do you think that men and boys get a rough deal when it comes to the state supporting them?
Massively. There's just a complete and utter lack of any kind of political structure to support men and boys in the issues they face. And what you tend to find is that where women and girls face an issue, and I have always been an advocate for support for men and boys in addition to women and girls, not in opposition to women and girls. I want to make that really clear. It's not a them versus us competition. But you just look at, where's the Minister for Men? Where is the strategy to prevent male suicide? I'm involved in a new initiative in the UK called the Coalition for Men and Boys, and there's a consultation going on with the big lottery fund. Where is the funding stream? We all, many people buy their ticket on a Wednesday or a Saturday to support the lottery, and there are tens of millions of pounds of that money goes specifically to women and girls initiatives. Where's the fund for men and boys? And it's not like people don't know there's an issue. The big lottery fund did a fantastic report 4 years ago highlighting the fact that very little of their money was going to men and boys, either to projects that specifically and only targeted men and boys, but also even in projects which were theoretically open to everyone and around issues which mostly affect, even around issues which mostly affected men, the big lottery found that men were not benefiting from the projects that they were setting up in the same way that women were. It's not like it's a big unknown, but we still continue to fail to act on the recommendations that come out of any kind of initiative like that, which is really simple. You have to target men and boys as a distinct group with specific needs. But that requires us to go beyond the gender story that we have, which is quite simply men are problems and women have problems. So until we change that thinking, the idea that women are at the effect of society and the problems that they cause are created collectively, and men are their own worst enemy, that men actually cause all their own problems. And we need to shift that thinking and treat men and boys the same as we treat women and girls, which was a group of people who, guess what, going through life, have some problems and need some help and support.
Now, on the steps of Downing Street, Theresa May, when she became Prime Minister, said that she wanted to target a whole host of areas where people face discrimination or aren't succeeding. And she mentioned about white boys in education. Elaborate on what issues there are around white boys in education and how they're lagging behind.
Yeah, I think specifically it was white working class boys, which is, again, this is nothing new. I first heard a politician talking about this in my time working in local government over in West London. And in fairness, it was a Labour councillor, Ruth Cadbury, who's now a member of Parliament, who first highlighted this. So the new Labour government wasn't particularly good at highlighting and addressing that so much. They did some work, to be fair, but it's just clear statistically, Matt, that if you look at how boys generally are performing in education, the education system is failing them compared to girls.
It's interesting that you should mention that, actually, because last year there was an MP who did make a stand for men and boys, and that was Philip Davis for the International Men's Day debate. Now, there was a big furore around this. Jess Phillips, off the back of it, ended up getting an awful lot of hate mail on Twitter. Do you think that the debate that took place last year, and this will lead on to what we're talking about to do with male suicide in a couple of minutes, do you think that helped raise the issue of men's issues and to get male suicide at the top of the agenda?
Yeah, I mean, it's a step forward. I mean, from a very personal perspective, as someone who is, I've always been more left-leaning and sort of a centre-left thinker, it's a bit uncomfortable for me to often find that my strongest allies in terms of advocating for men's issues are often the right-wingers, and often the right-wingers on the extremes as well, which is, on one level, it's like, oh, great. So there's a problem that the issue then gets sort of painted, perhaps in the way that the immigration conversation did, as a right-wing issue. And this isn't a right-wing issue, you know. Men and boys come from all political backgrounds. Men and boys are in all communities and all societies. Every single community in the entire country and the entire world has men and boys in it. So it was great that the debate happened. And even though I don't agree with him politically, full credit to Phil Davis for sticking his neck out and taking a stand. And I completely disagree with the abuse of Jess Phillips, but the political stance she took demonstrated the issue we have. Most politicians just kept quiet, but their keeping quiet is a kind of resistance, and they don't really want to address this issue because they don't think it makes political sense. They're resistant to addressing it, but they just keep quiet. To her credit, she actually spoke out her objections and revealed some of the barriers we face, that actually people are opposed to addressing men and boys' issues. They're not just not interested, they're actually actively opposed to treating men and boys as a group in society which needs help and support.
Now, you've gone on to found the Stop Male Suicide campaign in Australia. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so because of my personal circumstances, I'm in a long-term relationship with an Australian citizen, and I've been on a long-term promise to move over here once my daughter went off to university, which I fulfilled on at became an Australian resident in December 2015. And I have been coming over here and working particularly with the men's health sector in Australia, which is excellent. Small, but excellent. Things like Movember came out of Australia, and the men's sheds movement for older men came out of Australia. So Australia's doing some really innovative stuff. But in the UK, one of the organisations I was lucky to work with quite regularly is the Campaign Against Living Miserably, Calm UK, which is one of the few charities in the world which focuses specifically on male suicide. And there's no equivalent organisation in Australia. So in terms of working out where I could best make a difference here, I decided to set up this project, the Stop Male Suicide Project. And what we're doing is we're travelling around and running a series of 8 mini conferences, bring Stop Male Suicide in New South Wales, Stop Male Suicide in Western Australia, so on and so forth, and bringing together as many different people who are committed to stopping male suicide in that particular area and finding out what's out there and finding out what we can do to make a difference, because it's a massive issue. 13 men a day kill themselves in the UK. In Australia, it's 6 men a day and are 3 times more likely to take their own lives. And it's another of those issues where we go, ah, right, okay, well, that's because men don't get help. And it's like, oh, come on, get over it, will you? It's not about men not getting help. It's about us collectively being rubbish at helping men and not addressing the many issues that men face that can set them on the path to suicide.
Well, that wraps up this month's edition of Talking Men and the final episode in the current series. We hope to be back shining the spotlight on more men's issues again very soon. Thanks to all my regular contributors to the programme, including Councillor Nigel Beaumont.
Talking Men on Cambridge 105.